I'm Stephanie Gleason, senior reporter for The Deal, and this is Fresh Start. On this podcast, we're going to examine new issues in Chapter 11, looking back at recent and sometimes not so recent cases, to find out whether bankruptcy really is a fresh start. Today is our first episode, and I'm so excited. Joining me today for this first is Jared Elias. He is the Bion M. Gregory Chair of Business Law at the University of California, Hastings, and he's just published a new paper about a very hot topic in bankruptcy called The Rise of Bankruptcy Directors.
So first, thank you for having me, Stephanie, and it's great to get a chance to talk about this new project. This study, which we just made available publicly, but we've been working on for a couple of years, is joint work with my co-authors, Mehud Kamara and Kobi Castile at Tel Aviv University's Law School.
This is an issue that I think has been getting some notice since 9 West. That's when it came on my radar. And essentially what we're talking about is a trend in appointing independent directors with special bankruptcy experience to the board of a bankrupt or soon to be bankrupt company. There are directors that are appointed by a debtor and their owner, which is usually a private equity firm, 60% of the time, according to your research. And they often wind up investigating potential claims of self-dealing against the sponsor. So these claims can be a main source of recovery for unsecured creditors. The problem here seems obvious to me right away, but your research was able to quantify exactly how often this is happening. And to me, the headlines from your paper were just the explosion of this. We've seen the number of bankruptcy directors in 2004 was 3.7%. And now in 2019, 48.3% of Chapter 11 cases have bankruptcy directors. So almost half. And your research found that bankruptcy directors, their presence is associated with a 21% lowered recovery for unsecured creditors. So I think people had a feeling about what was going on anecdotally. Did you see what happened in 9 West, what happened in Neiman Marcus? But you were able to put some meat on the bones for people. And so could you tell us a little bit about your research, how you were able to quantify just what the effect of bankruptcy directors is?
So my co-authors and I became interested in this topic because we kept seeing stories like 9 West, as you mentioned, and also, you know, talking to different bankruptcy lawyers who were saying there's something changing in Chapter 11. There's something changing in the way that bankruptcy cases work, and it has to do with independent directors. And at the time that I was first informed this, it was a little bit puzzling to me because, you know, I'm a bankruptcy scholar. I was a bankruptcy lawyer once upon a time. You don't really think about the boardroom as being a main place where bankruptcy cases are fought. You know, bankruptcy is about the courtroom, right? It's about creditors and the debtor fighting. The board traditionally has played more of a passive role. And what we were able to see by going over cases, and we looked at all large cases that revealed their board of directors to the bankruptcy court and their statement to financial affairs that filed for bankruptcy between 2004 and 2019. And what we could see is over this period, a dramatic increase in the presence of these independent directors, we call them bankruptcy directors, in large bankruptcy cases. And so, you know, one of the questions that we had is, how is this associated with Chapter 11 outcomes? And we have to be careful here because this isn't a research design where we're sort of experimentally assigning Jared Elias to the board of some company, which would allow us to figure out what happens when you just add Jared to the board. You know, all of these companies are clearly adding these independent directors, these bankruptcy directors, as part of their bankruptcy planning. It's part of how they're dealing with financial distress, how they're going to figure out how they're going to navigate Chapter 11. And what we see in the data is that there's this association between the presence of these bankruptcy directors and relatively lower unsecured creditor recoveries. Or to state it a little bit differently, in the current era of Chapter 11, as opposed to where things were, say, during the financial crisis, when unsecured creditors are doing relatively worse on average, you have an independent director or a bankruptcy director on the board. And that's a different look for Chapter 11 than what we'd seen before. And we were able to get at that by collecting a lot of data and running regression models. Nothing terribly exciting. And we have to be careful again. We can't prove that these bankruptcy directors are causing these relatively worse unsecured creditor outcomes. But it clearly is a feature in the data of cases where unsecured creditors are doing relatively worse. There's a bankruptcy director in the boardroom. And that's just something new in the way that Chapter 11 works.
Yeah, absolutely. As you said, there's no direct link between bankruptcy director and lowered unsecured creditors. We can't say for sure, but that they are associated with lower recoveries. What does your research show? Why is that?
So there are a number of potential explanations. So the first explanation, and we should give the bankruptcy directors the benefit of the doubt and say, you know, maybe they're just being brought into the hard cases. Another possibility is that there's sort of a type of debtor out there that delays and delays and delays filing for bankruptcy. And during that period, there's potential self-dealing transactions with the shareholder or with lenders. And those people are especially likely to turn to a bankruptcy director to help them navigate the Chapter 11 process, right? So maybe there's a type of debtor out there that's going to pay relatively less in the way of an unsecured creditor dividend. Maybe these are private equity portfolio companies on average, something like that. Another possibility, which is a more pernicious one, which is the idea that what at least in some bankruptcy director engagements, and we should be careful because it only looks like about half of bankruptcy director engagements involve investigations of self-dealing claims. One possibility is that bankruptcy directors are associated with cases where the company has been looted to some extent by pre-bankruptcy shareholders or pre-bankruptcy creditors, and they're there to help kind of clean things up. You know, Nine West and Neiman Marcus are examples that look a little bit like that. Now, you could have a different take on what happened in those cases, but you know, that certainly is a possibility that is in the data. And it's something that I think we need more research on to learn more about.
Definitely. So there are plenty of reasons you could want to have an independent director, but there are certain cases where they are investigating these claims. And those cases tend to be the ones that are more problematic, right?
Yeah. So having an expert in the boardroom feels like a really good idea. If you look at the general trend in corporate law over the past 20 years, it's been towards let's have better people on the board. Let's have smarter people on the board. Let's have a more diverse board. Like, let's make sure the board isn't just an echo chamber for management and you have capable people who can act as advocates for shareholders. You know, that's been the great trend in corporate law. And so adding people who are restructuring experts to the board doesn't only make sense as a matter of logic, it fits with this general trend in corporate law. And it kind of makes sense. Like, companies are used to solving their problems with specialists in the boardroom. Like, this is something that they do. And it makes sense that this idea would migrate into the bankruptcy context. So it's a sensible thing. The problem potentially with this practice is if what these folks are doing is not necessarily making decisions that are in the best interests of creditors, but making decisions that are in the best interests of either themselves or the private equity sponsor while simultaneously saying we're actually acting in the best interests of creditors. You know, if you think about it, there are a lot of professionals that work for companies in Chapter 11. You know, many of the people who listen to your podcast, they're going to hire main counsel. They're going to hire local counsel. You would never say that these are objective actors. They're actors who are there to act on behalf of a client. And so one of the issues with this practice is that instead of folks joining the board and saying, I'm here to act on behalf of a client, they're saying, I'm here to act on behalf of everybody. I'm here to sort of distill the objective truth about how this case should go. And maybe there are cases where somebody can do that. That's kind of like a Chapter 11 trustee. But on average, we expect people to be loyal to the people who hire them for work. You know, just like you and I are loyal to our employers to some extent.
Right, right. You found some pretty close ties between bankruptcy directors and certain debtors' counsel. It's a small world in bankruptcy, and you found that to be problematic on its own.
Yeah. So the world of bankruptcy, as you know, is really small. Like, there, if you look at the bankruptcy cases of our sample period, you see the same lawyers who were like the leading lawyers in 2004, they tend to still be the leading lawyers in 2019, right? The same law firm.
That has not changed.
It has not changed. There's been some millennials kind of joining the elite of the debtors bar and the elite of the creditors bar. But on the whole, you know, the people who've been doing this for a living are seasoned. They've been in it for a while, and they're still the leading practitioners on both the lawyer side and on the financial advisor side. Absolutely true, right? So one of the problems this creates is that one of the ways in which we see bankruptcy directors in our sample try to demonstrate their independence is they say, well, I've been appointed, you know, let's use Nine West as an example. I've been appointed by Sycamore to join this board, but I'm actually an objective independent expert, which is why I'm capable of turning around and investigating Sycamore. I have no connection to them other than one day they got my phone number and called me and asked me to come and do this. right? And so, you know, that's plausible and you can certainly believe this to be true. And there's no reason not to give those folks the benefit of the doubt that that is in fact the mindset they had when they were acting on behalf of Nine West and its creditors. But the problem is that, you know, bankruptcy, because it's a small world and because bankruptcy law plays out in public, it's very easy to imagine that one might be tempted to approach their engagement as an opportunity to audition for future work. So even though I'm in my first bankruptcy director engagement, I'm representing private equity firm A, and private equity firm B, I have no connection to, but I know they're watching, right? Because I know they have troubled portfolio companies and they're looking for bankruptcy directors. Because one of the interesting features is that a private equity sponsor can't work with the same bankruptcy director more than once. Otherwise, there's clearly a conflict of interest. So this leads to a problem that we call auditioning bias, where you worry that bankruptcy directors might be tempted to audition for their next engagement as opposed to try to run the case for the benefit of creditors as a whole with a single-minded focus on creditor interests. And you know, that raises concerns that we think bankruptcy judges ought to do more to try to build scaffolding around, to think about what sort of legal protections and new procedures we might want to adopt now that this is this major new trend in the way that Chapter 11 is practiced.
Yeah, and you have some ideas about how a judge could protect against this better. It doesn't seem like this requires major new legislation, or it could, in your view, be fixed easily.
Yeah, bankruptcy judges have enormous discretion to force lawyers and creditors in front of them to do things. And one of the things we suggest they do is that if a debtor files for Chapter 11 and they have somebody on the board who's a bankruptcy expert who's going to be acting as an independent director, or they want to represent this person to the court as an objective independent expert, file a motion and hold a hearing to appoint this person, and let's give creditors a chance to weigh in. And if creditors don't think this person is independent, that's fine. They can still be the lead, you know, restructuring director on the board. They can still inform the board's deliberations. They can be the testifying witness. We just won't go through the facade of pretending that this person is independent, disinterested, and capable of acting for creditors as a whole when creditors as a whole don't agree.
I was wondering too, would you imagine that creditors, like the Unsecured Creditors Committee, would forfeit some of its rights to do its own investigation if it consented to the appointment of this independent director? Or do you think both things could work together if everyone is on the same page about the appointment?
So if you look at the cases where the judge appoints an examiner to investigate, for example, a pre-bankruptcy leverage buyout, and I think about lots and lots of cases have examiners.
Right.
Tribune famously had an examiner. In those cases, I do think that the Unsecured Creditors Committee concedes that they're going to lose some level of investigation agenda setting power to the neutral examiner who's been appointed by the bankruptcy court. And that's something that everybody accepts when it happens because they want to have an independent person looking at the transactions. But there's a key distinction within the examiner cases and the bankruptcy director cases, which is the examiner is appointed by the U.S. trustee's office or the bankruptcy judge. They're selected by those two neutral bodies that are appointed by federal law. They're not appointed by the pre-bankruptcy shareholders or the pre-bankruptcy board. So I do think that if the Unsecured Creditors Committee were to concede, we think that we put Jared Elias on the board and he's a truly independent objective expert. They are now giving Jared Elias the power to go in front of the judge and say, judge, I've investigated the pre-bankruptcy dividend, and I don't think that there was a constructive fraudulent transfer. But there are strategic reasons why you might want to do that. If you think your claims are really strong, for example, you might want an independent person in there to do that and to be the person to tell the judge, we think the claims are strong. So you will be giving things up if you're the Unsecured Creditors Committee if you concede that this person is independent. They're almost like an examiner, almost like a Chapter 11 trustee at that point. But there are strategic reasons why you might want to do it. And that should be a decision that creditors committee counsel and their clients make together.
And the benefit of doing that as opposed to allowing a judge and the U.S. trustee to appoint an examiner or a Chapter 11 trustee would be for shareholders that they've had some say in the beginning about who this person is. They might still see a benefit as opposed to just allowing an examiner to be appointed in the case.
Yeah, they could all concede, you know, we think that Jared is the right person to do this. We want Jared doing it. And then you don't have the situation that you sometimes have in some of the large cases where an examiner is appointed and it's somebody who the shareholders really didn't want to deal with. Like they can find somebody out there who has a great reputation, think a retired bankruptcy lawyer or something, who is more than capable of doing the work and everybody thinks this person is credible. And that's the person who gets appointed instead of an unexpected dice roll that takes you to a different place. Also, you could get that going before the bankruptcy case is filed. So I'm a private equity sponsor. So think about Nine West. So Sycamore Partners owns Nine West. Nine West has potential fraudulent transfer problems based on pre-bankruptcy transactions between Nine West and Sycamore, where Sycamore bought a bunch of Nine West assets, you know, arguably for less than the reasonably equivalent value of those assets. So I know that this company is going to bankruptcy and there's going to be messy litigation, right? So the approach they took is they put bankruptcy directors on the board who then basically took the investigation out of the hands of the creditors committee. But instead, they could have called up their major unsecured creditors, and although obviously there's no creditors committee appointed, and said, we know we have this problem. Why don't we mutually agree that we're going to put Jared on the board and Jared's going to do this? And so that way, when we file for bankruptcy, we're 2/3 of the way through the investigation and we can fight about settlement amount and we don't have to be in bankruptcy court for a long time, right? That would be a great example of how a practice like this could improve the way the Chapter 11 works.
And you note several times in your paper that what we're talking about here when we say unsecured creditors, these are sophisticated investors. Like the firm on the other side of the transaction in Nine West was Aurelius. Like these are not new to the bankruptcy game. So they would certainly have incentive to play ball on the front side, it seems like. But do you think that this benefits unsecured creditors who aren't as sophisticated, who are caught up in the ride of this? Can they benefit from an independent director that is consented to by the unsecured creditors committee? Or is this stand to be more of a problem for them?
So there's always challenges in bankruptcy between sophisticated creditors and unsophisticated creditors. You know, you look at the PG&E bankruptcy recently in California, you had the hedge fund creditors, the hedge fund bondholders, then you had the fire survivors, and they ended up with somewhat different outcomes from the bankruptcy case, in part because one group was more sophisticated and had money and other things than the other group. So that's always going to be a tension, but I trust bankruptcy judges to police the bankruptcy system and to protect the less sophisticated creditors when need be. And in general, when you look at the larger bankruptcy cases, it's the sophisticated creditors that want to fight pre-bankruptcy fraudulent transfers to death. It's not the less sophisticated creditors or, you know, the trade creditors. Like they have a strong interest in the firm reorganizing. And so I think that if you can satisfy the need of the Aurelius's of the world to litigate a transaction like Nine West to death, Nine West landlords are going to go along with it and follow the lead of the Aurelius's of the world because they were already kind of a voice of caution, as in, well, you know, it'd be great if we could get that money back, but what we really want is to keep having this tenant.
Right. We want Nine West to still exist after this.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, if the creditors don't consent to the independent director, they decide to have more of an adversarial relationship with the independent director. Do you think that having the viewpoint of this person is a non-neutral party, that going into the case, that is enough to protect against some of the negative outcomes that unsecured creditors might see in terms of dramatically lowered recoveries?
It's helpful. I think it's helpful. Yeah. It's not a panacea. So if you think about like what unsecured creditors face in the modern Chapter 11 environment, it's not just bankruptcy directors, right? You know, people claiming to be independent and they're like, no, they're not independent. You're a shill for the private equity sponsor. You know, it's plan support agreements and restructuring support agreements that force the debtor to reorganize in a certain way in an incredibly short period of time. Within the realm of the uphill battle that unsecured creditors often have in modern Chapter 11, you know, the good creditors committee lawyers have found ways to function and to sort of overcome those obstacles as best as possible. I don't think that it fully fixes, you know, the basic problem of they're not in control of the debtor. They're on the outside looking in. They're often throwing rocks at the debtor. And the debtor is promising to leave bankruptcy quickly and protect the jobs of the employees. It won't fully solve that kind of bargaining imbalance, but it's helpful. It also eliminates the distraction of instead of attacking the merits of the potential fraudulent transfer claims in Nine West, you're now spending a lot of time attacking the veracity and independence of two bankruptcy directors. So it saves the creditors committee from having to go through a kind of unproductive exercise of attacking somebody's independence. And it allows them to present their own viewpoint to the judge on the transaction. And the bankruptcy director, who we will concede now is not independent, can present the debtor's view of the world, and they can present their view of the world. And then it's up to the bankruptcy judge to decide how to deal with that.
Certainly. Yeah. As you said, there are so many things now that debtors have in their playbook that this seems like it's just another one of them. And having agreed from the beginning that this person is not a neutral party, you think about Neiman Marcus, how that case might have played out a little differently on the front side if unsecured creditors hadn't had to try to prove that these directors were not advocating for their interests. It might have been very different.
Yeah, it totally could have been. And you think about how Judge Jones and Neiman Marcus said in court, you know, I took comfort in the fact that I had independent directors in there. And then he was convinced at trial that one of the independent directors was not perhaps doing his job as well as he could have. And that person subsequently left the board because of health issues. I think that there's a real fear among unsecured creditors that because this person claims they're independent, that they have the upper hand in bargaining. And because they present a settlement to the judge and they say, judge, it's a messy situation. I'm just kind of like a referee and I'm coming to the right conclusion. And judge, let's protect this company and get it out of bankruptcy. That it kind of stacks the deck against them and makes the process unfair. So the reforms that I'm talking about in this project or the sort of guardrails that I suggest judges ought to build, they don't necessarily, again, solve the fundamental problem that unsecured creditors don't control the company. They're often fighting an uphill battle, but they're potentially helpful and they potentially help to restore the perception of fairness in some of these larger cases that become tainted with questions about director independence that are utterly unnecessary questions.
Right. I mean, there were definitely some pretty scorched earth moments, it seemed like, in Neiman Marcus. You quote one part in your paper, the lawyer for the Unsecured Creditors Committee, who says to the judge after they've decided to accept the settlement, with that said, Your Honor, my goal in doing this is for Your Honor to understand why it is that the system is rigged in this case and why sponsors going forward and in the past are encouraged to asset strip, because that's just how the system is set up. And until Congress or somebody does something about that, that's how it's going to remain. So what you're suggesting that they could very easily do is from the beginning, just hold a hearing.
Yeah. And you think of, so that case actually happened, you know, to give you a little bit of background on writing the paper, we'd been collecting data for, you know, almost a year at that point. And then that case happened and that lawyer for the creditors committee got up in court and gave this impassioned monologue about how we really need to police this new practice of bankruptcy directors and something has changed here and this feels unfair. And obviously we're very happy to add that quote to the paper to help to motivate what's going on in the real world. But I think he was speaking for the frustration of the universe of bond investors and others who feel like the deck has been stacked against them and they're not getting what they see as a fair outcome or a fair process in some of these cases. And it seems like something like that could be dealt with. And Judge Jones asked him, you know, he said to him, like, there really isn't anything right now that puts director independence in front of me. What do you think I should do? And in this project, I think we're providing one idea on how to answer that question.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you gotten feedback since the paper's been out? I'm really interested if any judges have expressed interest in implementing your suggestions, but from practitioners as well, saying we need to rethink how this is approached.
So I think it's fair to say that the paper has caused a splash among practitioners in the sense that I've received a lot of emails from people saying they enjoyed it and they liked it and they learned a lot from it. I haven't heard anything from judges, but I wouldn't expect a judge to reach out to me. I also, you know, I would imagine
that judges, not calling you up.
No, not quite yet. But I imagine that they will. I get the sense that bankruptcy judges don't have a handle on what the universe looks like. And what we're doing in this paper is we're laying out for them this is what's happening. It's not that you're seeing a bankruptcy director in one or two cases. This is a real trend and change in the way that Chapter 11 works. Right. And historically, when the bankruptcy practitioners have innovated and come up with new things that have added tremendous value to the Chapter 11 process, think debtor in possession financing, the modern version that we have. Bankruptcy judges eventually create guardrails for it to strike a balance between what's good for the debtor and what's good for the debtor's creditors, another thing. So my hope is that this project helps bankruptcy judges see what's happening out there and to build some of those guardrails and to speed along the process of putting that together. But no, they are not calling me and asking me to come and tell them how to run their courts. But I didn't think they were going to. They know they're better than I am at that.
Yeah. I mean, it seems as though it's the job of debtors' lawyers to be innovative and come up with new and better ways to do things. And then it's the judge's job to, as you said, put up some guardrails to make sure that this is benefiting everyone in this case. So I think that the raw data, it's made it not anecdotal anymore. It doesn't seem like it's just one thing that happened in one case. Like, this is really a widespread issue affecting unsecured creditors.
It turns out to be bigger. You know, that's what we were surprised by. Like, right. We thought maybe this is a Nine West Neiman thing. You only see in these big private equity asset stripping cases. It's increasingly everywhere.
Right.
And the big trend.
Right. I was really fascinated too in the idea of the super repeaters that you talk about. We're not talking about a huge number of independent directors here. I mean, you found that for most of the independent directorships are going to just a handful of people, I think 15 that you were able to identify. That seems to be a part of the problem as well.
So what was very clear as we did this study is that there's a small group of people. They're not getting most of the independent directorships, but they're getting a lot of them. And they're getting especially a lot of them in some of the higher profile cases. There's a small group of people who've developed this profession of being professional bankruptcy directors. They specialize in sitting on the boards of distressed companies. By background, they're usually former bankruptcy lawyers or investment bankers or distressed debt traders. And they are all over the place. And on the one hand, that's potentially really good. Like, expertise is a good thing. There's a reason why Harvey Miller was the go-to bankruptcy lawyer for debtors for 50 years or whatever, because being the expert is really helpful. And companies want that expertise. On the other hand, it does create concerns that goes back to this potential problem of auditioning, where you worry that people may only act with an eye towards their next engagement as opposed to trying to maximize the value for unsecured creditors or creditors as a whole in this particular case. So it's kind of like a double-edged development where on the one hand, I think it's potentially fantastic. On the other hand, it definitely raises questions. Now, bankruptcy judges, on average, once you build guardrails, will probably come to love it because these folks are just going to be great witnesses in court, so much better than somebody's CFO taking the stand who's never been in a bankruptcy courtroom before. And it stands to reason they can be allies to the bankruptcy judge in running a professional bankruptcy case, but raises concerns that we ought to think about how we might want to address.
Right. Like so many things in bankruptcy, like there's a tension between, as you said, experience and people who are really good at what they do. And so they are on a lot of cases. And as you said, the natural inclination to wanting to be on a lot of cases and what kind of incentives that sets up. I had been thinking too a lot about whether judges would want to implement something like this. We know that venues want to be friendly to debtors to an extent, but certainly judges want to do a good job with the cases they have as well. And as you said, that independent directors are helpful to judges. I wouldn't think that they have too many reservations about them being in the case if they can find a way to make sure that they're representing creditors' interests as well as the debtors. Is that your sense that this is something that they have some incentive to try to implement?
I think so. It definitely is the case that bankruptcy judges are on the group a sort of service-oriented bunch, especially the ones who see a lot of large cases. They make themselves and their calendar available to debtors. They understand the importance and the complexity of the issues that are in front of them. They read first day papers, you know, the night before, and they show up in court with comments on several hundred pages of pleadings. Like, it's a hardworking group that cares a lot about the debtors that are in front of them. And I know that there's been criticism in the past that there are judges out there who, you know, like Lynn Lopucky at UCLA has this long line of criticism that judges are too deferential to debtors. They're too deferential to law firms. I don't agree with that criticism. And I also don't think that judges would necessarily be causing a gigantic stir by saying, we're going to start treating bankruptcy directors the same way we treat financial advisors or law firms. Like, there will be a hearing. We're going to think about the conflicts of interest they might have. They'll provide disclosure. We'll see if everybody agrees that this person is fit to represent this party. And there have been cases where bankruptcy judges have said, you know what, the debtor wants to hire this law firm. This law firm has conflicts and can't do it. Or this law firm isn't well situated to do it for whatever reason. So, you know, I don't think that policing the boundaries of the boardroom around the edges is something that would alienate anybody. I think that actually debtors would like it because it would then provide a clear role for these bankruptcy directors in Chapter 11, which right now, to some extent, they kind of lack because there's nothing in the bankruptcy code that says thou shalt appoint an independent director who's done seven other engagements onto your board to be your testifying witness.
Right. There's not those parameters yet, which makes sense. How many companies did you have to look at to learn about bankruptcy directors?
So in order to learn more about bankruptcy directors, we started with a very naive assumption, which is we should look at all large firms that filed for bankruptcy between the beginning of 2004 and the end of 2019 that had more than $250 million in assets or liabilities. And that was about 770 firms. And we had a team of research assistants actually working here in San Francisco, as well as in Israel, going through this and then checking each other's work. And they looked at all of those dockets and they focused on the cases where there were two documents. One of them was a statement to financial affairs that disclosed who was on the board. And that was 528 companies. And then of those companies, we were able to obtain disclosure statements for 454 of them. And that 454 of them was the sample. And we were able to identify about 2,500 directors who sat on these boards, including a number of repeat players who are on multiple boards.
And you found in about half of those cases are the ones that bankruptcy directors performed investigations as well.
In about half of the bankruptcy director cases, which half in the most recent years, but you know, not in 2004.
Right. Of course. So half in the recent ones.
Yeah.
Were there any ways that the bankruptcy director cases were different from the non-bankruptcy director cases that stood out?
Yeah, in a few ways, there were some differences. So more commonalities than differences. They were all bankruptcy cases of similar size, similar amounts of liabilities. The cases with bankruptcy directors were significantly more likely to have a private equity sponsor than the cases without bankruptcy directors. And that's especially true if you cut the sample and you look in the more recent years. Like, clearly, to some extent, the bankruptcy director trend is a change in the way that private equity portfolio firms are preparing for bankruptcy that we see over the sample period. They're more likely to have a controlling shareholder. They're less likely to be publicly traded. They're more likely to be represented by Kirkland & Ellis or Weil Gotshal, which isn't terribly surprising, given that those are the two dominant bankruptcy debtor side firms. They're more likely to have a restructuring support agreement, which makes sense because the bankruptcy directors are often the ones negotiating that agreement. Apart from that, though, like, they are similar length bankruptcies. Unsecured creditors turn out to do not as well in the bankruptcy director cases when you control for some things. But, you know, on the whole, they look fairly similar in a lot of ways. Like, it's not the case that it's the large companies that are getting bankruptcy directors and the smaller ones that are not. It's not a size thing. It's a, you know, what are the issues in the case? Who owns the company? And how recently did they file for bankruptcy?
And as you said, many of them have restructuring support agreements, or they're using other tools that we see debtors try to implement these days to be effective in bankruptcy. So this is one of several tools that you saw that these debtors in particular were using.
Yeah, that's correct. I think that the bankruptcy director tool is just the latest and greatest legal innovation to come from the private bar to help companies deal with financial distress. And whether it's coming from the law firms or it's coming from sort of a group of the super repeaters who you mentioned, the people who are specialized in this, who are entrepreneurial and are helping to create this role, That I have no idea, but it's coming from somewhere. And it's coming from demand from the top, because you have more companies that have remained sort of on the brink of bankruptcy for longer. So they maybe have more issues that you need a specialist whose objective to sort out in Chapter 11. But it's coming from lots of places, and it's clearly now a feature of Chapter 11 and a device that sophisticated firms are using to help navigate bankruptcy.
And there's certainly no evidence that this is going away. You think it will just continue to increase?
Yeah, it certainly seems like we are going to be living with bankruptcy directors going forward, just like we've learned to live in bankruptcy world with restructuring support agreements and chief restructuring officers and the other things that have come along the way. And all of these are key ingredients to why the United States has the world's best bankruptcy system, because we're constantly innovating, improving, trying new things out. And so this is just the latest and greatest invention.
And 21% decreased recoveries for unsecured creditors. Do you think that that is an essential feature of having an independent director, or if creditors can be able to do as well in Chapter 11 cases as they were without independent directors, that there will be a continuation of the trend?
So that's a tough question. There's certainly no rule that says that if you have an expert in the boardroom, unsecured creditors have to do worse. So in some ways, like, you might expect that trend to disappear as increasingly all large firms that want to file for bankruptcy add a bankruptcy expert to their board. But it doesn't have to be the case that you see this association in the data. And one explanation of it is that there are other companies out there that could benefit from boardroom expertise, and they currently aren't getting that boardroom expertise. And so maybe that's one of the problems we need to fix. Another explanation is that maybe these bankruptcy directors are just coming into the toughest situations only, or maybe they're making decisions that are not in the best interests of the firm's creditors. All of those are potential stories. And what's interesting is, if you think of this study as being about, we call it the rise of bankruptcy directors, because these are the early innings of bankruptcy directors. I suspect the middle innings will look different.
Absolutely. I really appreciate your expertise on this topic. And we will certainly be following it closely in the coming years.
Yep, I think it's going to become a big story in Chapter 11 going forward, in the same way the key employee incentive plans are. So this is where we are.
One of those things we write about for every case, I think.
Yes.
This is Stephanie Gleason for Fresh Start. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.